Good morning and welcome back to Nachiyomi. Today we're going to focus on the third perek of Sefer Shoftim. And now we really get into Shoftim in earnest. This is the perek where it all starts. The perek starts off by telling us that Israel didn't really conquer at all. Although when we read through Sefer Yehoshua, the seeming outcome is that yes, Israel did do a lot. Here we get the flip side of the coin. Here's what they didn't do. So we're told that they left over the Chameshes Sarnei Plishtim. Those are the five Philistine princes. They are in the Gaza area who remained. All the Canaanites, all the Sidonites, the Chivi who lived in the this is the Lebanon area up the coast, which was supposed to be Israel. And finally, the rest of Israel, although they vanquished their enemies somewhat, they still lived among the Canaanites, the Hittites, the Amorites, the Perizzites, the Hivites, and the Jebusites. So I mean to say that the picture we're getting here is not a very wholesome picture of conquest. And in fact, we're told by Tanakh that they intermarried. They just, you know, gave it a few short generations. They, you know, hung out together, went to the same colleges and ate in the, you know, the same restaurants, and that's what ended up happening. They started intermarrying each other, which leads to our round one of the cycle. Round one of the cycle is what happens is Israel is sinning, they're intermarrying, they're getting involved in society, they start serving Avodah Zorah, really enculturating into the Canaanite society, and God sells them the first time. God sells them out, puts them under the control of a person by the name of Kushan Rishathaim. You know, the name really says it all. You know, Rishathaim, you know, double evil, pretty bad guy. He's from Aram Naharaim. So he's from the area of Assyria. Up north, he comes in and he subjugates Israel. And this takes 8 years, in which Israel are now paying taxes to Kushan Rishathaim. Of course, that's the stage one of the cycle, as we remember. Stage two of the cycle is Israel calls out. They call out to Hashem and they said, Hashem, please, we're so sorry. Hashem sends them a leader. We've met this leader before. The leader's name is Othniel ben Knaz. Othniel ben Knaz is, in fact, the son-in-law of Kalev. He's the one who won the hand of Achsa, the daughter of Kalev ben Yefuneh, by winning the area of Kiryas Sefer. So a very powerful man, spiritually, now we know also physically, succeeds in conquering the Kushan Rishathaim, pushing him back to Aram, and succeeds in remaining what's called Vatishkota Oretz Arba'im Shana, a 40-year reprieve. That's going to be a very important number. We're going to see the number 40 as a wholesome number in terms of good leadership. So we need to keep that in mind as we see all the different Shoftim and sort of compare them to that 40. That's going to be our default number of success. So what happens is that unfortunately, Othniel ben Knaz dies, so we've had, you know, 8 years of subjugation, now 40 years of peace under Othniel, which by the way is a good ratio, meaning there's more good time than there is bad time. But now we enter into the next round, round two. Round two is where Israel continued doing bad. They just didn't get the message. They carry on intermarrying, they carry on getting involved, they carry on serving Avodah Zorah. So the next adversary is a person by the name of Eglon. Eglon is the king of Moab, so we're talking in the Jordan area in today's map, you know, Transjordan down south. He comes in and he subjugates Israel, and they are paying taxes to Eglon and his neighbors, the Amalekim, for 18 years. So we can see now there's an increase in the subjugation. And what happens was Hashem inspires an individual whose name is Ehud ben Gera. Ehud ben Gera comes from the tribe now of Binyamin. He is an Iter Yad Yamino. That means to say he is a left-handed swordsman. That either means to say that he's ambidextrous or that his right hand is not in service. He can't use it. So what happens is at this point in time, Israel has to pay their taxes. And not only taxes, but they pay allegiance to Eglon. So they send a delegation led by Ehud. They come to the castle, the stronghold of Eglon, and Ehud says to the king of the king Eglon, he says, I have something to tell you secretly in the name of God. And the king ushers out everybody else. And at that point in time, Ehud pulls out a sword. Now, in those days, they did check people coming into the king's palace. But here's the thing. Everybody used to be a right-hand swordsman in those days. Everybody fought with their right hand, which means that their sword belonged on their left flank. That's how you draw it. But Ehud, being a left-handed swordsman, was a very unusual person. So where did he keep his sword? On his right flank. They didn't check it. The metal detectors weren't doing such a good job when they were checking out Ehud. So he actually had a small sword on his right flank. What happens is, as your king sends out everybody from the castle, from this attic where he is staying, the uppermost chamber, Ehud comes close to him and sticks it into him. The Tanakh describes Eglon as being a bari. He is a very healthy man. That means to say he's a very, very fat man. He sticks the blade completely into him to the point that actually, disgustingly enough, some of his innards come out, killing Eglon. Ehud then leaves the attic leaves the throne room, locks the door behind him, and makes a dash for it in a very covert way. In the meantime, his guards are standing on the outside, and they're knocking on the door, and they think that the reason why the door's closed is because Eglon must be using the bathroom. They finally break in, and then they realize that, lo and behold, Eglon is killed. They try to chase after Ehud, but in the meantime, Ehud passes the quarries, enters back into Israel, and rallies to the call the people in Har Ephraim. And he blows the shofar, everybody comes down with him, and he leads the army to reprise and send and kill the Moabites. Remember, the Moabites are from the east, so he pushes them out of his territory in order to retain the sovereignty of Israel in Israel proper. And at this point in time, they killed 10,000 of these Moabites. They're described as Ishar Kol Shamein, these fat, healthy Moabites, and without losing a single casualty in battle. And at this point in time, they regained sovereignty for 80 years. That's double the period of Othniel, huge amount of time. And in fact, there's no round three, there's no sinking back before the next Shofet miraculously comes into place. We know very little about him. His name is Shamgar ben Anas. Shamgar ben Anas is going to be our third Shofet, who controls Israel. He pushes back the Plishtim with his 600 men. That's all we really know about him. So what we've done is we've covered in this perek the devolution. We cover three shoftim over here and the reprisal. One quick point to ponder when it comes to this perek, food for further thought. The interesting thing is that you have Ehud, who is a man of Binyamin, who now comes into the throne room of Eglon, who's the king of Moab. We know a lot of interesting things about this whole operation over here. And that is the following. The Midrash says that when Eglon heard that the word of Hashem was about to be told to him, He ushered everybody out and he stood up. Even though he was a very fat man, he stood up because he wanted to hear the word of the Hebrew God. Now, in that merit, that he had that respect to God, the Midrash says that Eglon, in fact, had a daughter. Her name was Rus. Rus was going to be the scion of King David and the Davidic dynasty. Fascinating. So here you have an interesting play around, because we do have another instance in Tanakh, which we're approaching in the Parashas HaShavua, where there is a person who enters the throne room of a king trying to defend a brother. And think about this for a second. That's Yehuda defending Binyamin when he comes into the throne room of the unknown king, the viceroy of Egypt. There he is defending his brother Binyamin. Isn't it fascinating that over here we have the switch around exactly 180 degrees? Here we have the scion of Binyamin, Ehud ben Gera, walking in, and ultimately, because of his word, he merits to create or allow the space for Rus to come, who's going to be ultimately the scion for the king of Yehuda himself. So there's this fascinating switch around over here, which we're going to be focusing on, God willing, as we develop these themes as we go further through Nach. In the meantime, have a wonderful and meaningful day.